There's a story which some of you may have heard me telling before, but I guess some may not have, so I can probably get away with telling it again. It was about a doctor in Bangkok, and he used to work at the Sirirat Hospital in Bangkok, which any of you might know is a very large general hospital. One day he arrived on the morning shift to come to work early in the morning, went into the hospital and opened the lift, and there at the bottom of the lift, lying unconscious, was one of his companions, another doctor, lying in a dead faint on the floor of the lift. So of course a hospital is a very good place to be unconscious if you have to be unconscious somewhere. So they picked him up and took him to a bed, and when he revived, they asked him what happened. And he said to them, "You won't believe what happened to me this morning." And that morning he'd been working on the night shift, and he'd finished his shift and was coming down in the lift. He was working on the top floor in the hospital, got in the lift to come down. That is one of the floors, then the lift stopped and the doors opened and the nurse got in. And the doors closed, they went down to the next floor, the doors opened, and there was this patient, this lady, was standing at the doors. And as soon as he saw the patient standing there, the doctor immediately slammed the close button on the lift. And the doors shut, and the lady patient was left standing outside the lift. And the nurse said to him, "What did you do that for? Didn't you see? There was a lady standing there. She wanted to get on the lift." And the doctor said, "Yes." He said, "I know. I saw her standing there." He said, "I know that lady. She was one of my patients. I operated on her earlier this evening. The operation was not successful. She died earlier this evening. Didn't you see? Around her wrist, she had a red band. This is the red band we put around the corpses when we take them down to the morgue." And then when she heard that, the nurse was terrified. She looked up at the doctor. She said, "Doctor, does that mean..." And she held up her hand. "Does that mean I'm dead too?" And she also had a red band around her wrist. And it was at that point that the doctor collapsed in a faint on the floor of the lift. Oh, you're all laughing now. Would you have been laughing if it had happened to you? There's always this kind of nervous, slight fear, and it kind of makes us giggle. But then they investigated that in the hospital, and actually the nurse had been driving her car on her way to work that morning and had an accident, had a car crash, and been killed. And they'd taken her body into the morgue in the hospital. And obviously she died, but she didn't know it. Seems slightly strange, doesn't it? How can you die, but you don't even know that you're dead? Well, maybe it's not so strange after all. We go through a lot of our life without actually knowing it, don't we? Yeah. Often we wake up in the morning, we walk around the house, we don't know what we're doing, do we? We just walk around, we bump into things, trip over them, we say all kinds of things, we don't have any mindfulness. If we don't know even when we're alive, why should we be surprised if we're not aware when we're dead? Yeah? So this is one of the things the Buddha said, like this practice of mindfulness is always a practice which will lead to us dying in a sense of peace. And there's quite a beautiful phrase I was reading in one of the Sanskrit suttas the other day, and it was talking about one of the great kings. It was like a Jataka story, when the Bodhisattva, one of the Buddha's past lives, and he practiced Brahma Viharas, practiced metta meditation very deeply, and attained to jhana. And then it said when he passed away, when he died, the feeling of when he died was just like of a man who's tired and goes to sleep. It's like falling asleep at the end of the day. And it's like that's what that death was to him. Yeah? That's how little pain and suffering there was because of his purity of mind and his strength of mindfulness. Just, you know, die, just let you go to sleep. And that's all there is to it. Yeah? A beautiful way to die. But I always think that, you know, when we come to Dhamma practice, then there has to be some reason for it. I think there has to be some very deep reason for it. It's a very strange thing to do, to come to Buddhist practice. I mean, if you go to a, for example, if you go to a, say to a university, let's say you might go to the biology department, and the biology department, they will tell you that your behavior is motivated by a desire to reproduce and to sustain future generations, and so they will understand your behavior like that. Well, you haven't come here for that reason, have you? That's not what's brought you here. It might be what takes you to a nightclub or a singles bar or something like that, but it's not what brings you here. Or if you go to ask an economist, for example, he will tell you that, you know, you're being motivated by your demands and your desire to consume. And because you want to consume this and consume that, that's why you make your choices. But again, you haven't come here for that reason. That's not what's urging you on. What exactly is it? What is that force, that urge in our mind that brings us to Dhamma practice? It's not any of those normal urges that we think that our lives are being driven by. It's something else. And I think one of the most important of all of those motive forces that actually gets us going is the fear of death. Yeah? It's that idea that someday, sometime, we don't know when, we're going to die. And one of the people at the conference was saying that they had like a, I think at their center or their monastery or something, they had like their application form. When you go and stay there, you have to write your name, your address and telephone number, date of birth, and the date of your death. And of course you get to that one, you think, oh, hang on, I don't know. Yeah? And of course, no, we don't know what day we're going to die. Oh, I'll put down maybe in 50 years' time, I'll put down that one, and keep it safe. Yeah? But we don't want to do that. We don't know when we're going to die. Could be any time. And again, at the conference when I was talking about this, and I asked, I said to everybody, did you have a nice sleep? They said, everyone in the room nodded and said, yes. I said, before you went to sleep, did you think to yourself, I might not wake up? Everybody said, no. Yeah? This is how we should be reflecting every time we go to sleep. Maybe we're not going to wake up. There's lots of people in the world that are like that, aren't there? Thousands every day. One of the speakers there was also talking about death, and he said in the 20 minutes that he's giving his talk, he had the figures, I think he said 6,000 people died in that talk. And I think there was, you know, the figures are very amazing, and one of them was like, I think 1,200 or something like that. Children would die of malnourishment and neglect and disease in that 20 minutes that he was giving the talk. Something really to think about, isn't it? Our lives are just so fragile. Yeah? When the Buddha asked about the monks, he asked, well, how do you contemplate death? And one of them said, well, Pante, he said, I think every year, I think maybe I won't make it through to the next year. Maybe this will be my last year left alive. I better practice this year. And the Buddha said, you slacker. And then somebody else says, well, Bhante, I think, well, when we get to our Upasita night, when we have to recite our Parimokkha rules, I think maybe I won't make it to the next fortnight to recite the Parimokkha rules again. So I better really practice hard. And the Buddha said, you're just as bad as the first guy. And then the next one says, well, Bhante, whenever I'm leaving out to walk on alms round, we walk into the village to collect our alms food, I think maybe I'm not going to make it back from the alms round. And the Buddha said, you're hopeless, you lot. And then the next one said, Bhante, I think whenever I breathe in, I think maybe I'm not going to breathe out. And whenever I breathe out, I think maybe I'm not going to breathe in. So with every in-breath, I better be mindful, I better be alert, there is much that I can do. With every out-breath, I had better be alert, I better be mindful, there is much that I can do. And so the Buddha said, okay, now some, at least one monk here who's really practicing. So this is how we should practice, is awareness of death every moment of every day. And of course that doesn't mean that we become morbid. And this is something of course which is can be a lot of misconceptions. I know being brought up in a Western country, we tend to want to shove death away. We don't want to know about it. We put our old people in old folks' homes and we don't like to go and see them very much. And when people die, we don't see the corpses and things like that. Everything's very pristine. Even if they put the corpse on display, then it's just like in a coffin, and it's been kind of done up and there's lots of makeup and things. It doesn't really look like a dead person anymore. And even then, sometimes people just keep the coffin closed. You can't see it at all. So people might go through their whole life and they hardly even see a dead person. When I went to Thailand the first time, and I was a tourist, I was just wandering around and I went to the main square in Chiang Mai. And they were having a medical exhibition there, like a bit of an expo, a small expo in the main town square in Chiang Mai. And I went there and they actually had two cadavers, real live dead people, and cut up and dissected on display in the main square. And you can go and see them. Wow, it's something you don't see in Perth very often. And it just shows in that culture, like in a Buddhist culture, that death is something that's just much more natural. It's part of life. And in villages, you know, you see that people die. And, you know, you're just used to that. You have the funeral and everybody will come. Everybody sees the corpse and these kinds of things. It's not anything which is unusual or abnormal. So this is, of course, a much healthier attitude towards these things, because the more we try to push it away, the more we try to deny it, then the more it will really come to hurt us and to cause us a lot of pain and suffering when the time comes. So this is why we have to try and practice meditation as much as we can. In meditation, we are learning to, as Ajahn Chah would always say, we're learning to die before we die. Yeah? Die before you die, this is what he would always say. When people come to stay in the monastery, they say, Ajahn, I'd like to come and stay and practice in your monastery and do some meditation. And Ajahn Chah would nod and say, yes. He said, well, are you ready to die yet? And if they said, oh, no, he'd say, well, get out of here. You're not ready to practice. So this is this saying that they'd always say in Thai, Dai Gon Dai. Die before you die. And so in our meditation, we're learning to die to the world. We're dying to our bodies, our feelings, our ideas, our thoughts. We're not being attached to them. We're letting them go. And so, of course, death is nothing more than just a big letting go, isn't it? We're having to let go of our bodies. We're letting go of our families. We're letting go of our wealth, all these kinds of things. Yeah? So in our meditation, we're already training ourselves to do that. When we're in our meditation, we're not concerned, for example, about our families. That doesn't mean we don't love our families and we don't care for them. But in the time when we're meditating, we bring our awareness inwards. We're looking into the mind. So those things don't exist. We're not concerned about our financial worries. That doesn't mean we don't look after our finances. It doesn't mean we can't have any money. But it means that now is the time for meditation. We let go. We learn to let go of those things. We're not concerned about our houses. It doesn't mean we don't have houses. We have somewhere to live. But it means now is the time to let go, to come inwards. And we're practicing with that all the time. The more we practice with that, the more we practice with that letting go, the easier it will become. And the lighter will be our touch. As Ajahn Chah would always say, he'd say, hold. Hold things, you know. Don't let go of things, hold them, but hold them lightly. Yeah? Don't grip them. If you grip it very hard, then you'll crush it. Yeah? But hold something lightly. Just enough strength that you need to be able to hold it and pick it up. And then when your time is finished, then you can put it down. And you let go of it lightly as well, without damaging it. And it's the same in our meditation. When we have done our activities, done our duties, the things that we need to do in the world, we do those things as best we can. We apply ourselves to those things 100% all the time. And then we let go. We come to meditation. And also you take up your meditation lightly. You hold your meditation object, maybe the breath, or the feeling of metta, or whatever it might be. And we hold those, but we hold them lightly. We don't crush them, because the mind is like a very, very gentle flower, yeah, like a lotus flower or a rose. Yeah? And we have to hold it very, very softly and gently. The mind, we can't even use similes like that, because actually roses and flowers and things are so much more coarse and crude than the mind is. The mind is something that's very, very delicate and gentle. We have a flower in Australia called the wattle. It has this blossom. And as you know, Australia is a bit of a rough country. We've got lots of very deadly snakes and centipedes and scorpions and crocodiles and sharks and deadly jellyfish and just about anything you can imagine. And a lot of prickly and thorns and rocks and stuff. But there are some things that are also very delicate and soft, and one of the things is this wattle blossom. And it's just this little spherical blossom. And one thing that I noticed when I just, one time I was just there, and it was like golden yellow, like little golden yellow rays coming out of this thing. And I noticed one time when you touched it, it's actually these little stems on it are so soft when you touch it that you can't actually feel it. Yeah? That's how delicate they are. Now you know how sensitive that your fingertips are. Very, very sensitive. You can feel just a tiny little unevenness in a surface or something. But this thing is just so delicate. You can see that they're moving with your eyes, but you can't actually feel it with your hand, yeah, with your fingertips. That's how soft and delicate. And that's exactly how delicate you need to be when you're doing your meditation. Yeah? This is that kind of hold that we need to have on the meditation object, with just that degree of delicacy and care and concern. And what they use similes in the suttas, for example, one simile they use is like, from the commentaries, not the suttas, is like if you, it used to be a way that they would train the surgeons in those days, yeah? Because a surgeon obviously has to have a very steady hand. So what they would do is they get like a lotus flower that's closed, a lotus bud. And the surgeon had to be able to cut through one of the petals with the scalpel, cut through the petals of the lotus bud, but without damaging the next petal inside. So you know how the lotus has all the layers of petals folded in on each other. So you have to cut through one completely, yeah, totally cut through one cleanly and completely without making a mark on the next petal. Yeah. So this is how delicate that you have to be. And this is what they use as a simile for samadhi. That's that application of the mind, very, very softly and delicately moving. And of course, this is when you can do this, you can hold your attention with your meditation, sustain it. Then, as you're letting go of the body, you're coming to this feeling where your mind starts to go in on itself. It's almost like you're starting to go out of your body. Now, of course, some people do really do that. They do actually go out of their body. They maybe feel themselves floating down the corridor or something like that. Or they can feel, I have all of these out-of-body experiences. And it's very interesting that these out-of-body experiences are just so similar to how people describe the near-death experiences. And I'm sure you've all heard of these kinds of things where, like a person dies and then, or they get very near death and then they leave the body and there's like a feeling of like a bright light, a radiance, and they're feeling like a great love and peace and joy. And often beings will come and greet them and guide them through a tunnel, like a feeling of moving into a tunnel. It sounds exactly like many people describe samadhi experiences. And it's interesting with those kinds of phenomenon that recently, I think it was December 2000, there was an article published in Lancet magazine. I'm not sure if you heard about that, but there was Lancet, of course, the most prestigious medical journal in the world. And that was one of the first very scientifically thorough studies of near-death experiences in Dutch hospitals. And they actually did a prospective study. They didn't just wait until they heard reports of near-death experiences and interview those people, but they actually surveyed all the people in the hospital and so on, so who came near to death, okay, cardiac patients and so on, and found out what percentage of them in fact had these kinds of near-death experiences and so on and so forth. Not all of them did. About, I think it was about 15% or something like that had a near-death experience, who had gone through like a cardiac arrest. You know, and some of the experiences, you know, were very, you know, they vary quite a lot in intensity and clarity and detail and so on. And, you know, one of the most important ones from a scientific point of view is there were some cases which are recorded where there's actually no brain activity at all. Yeah? There's no brain activity, and yet the person can remember certain things that occurred during that interval when they were brain dead, and they can in fact recollect and accurately describe them. And so those particular kinds of episodes are very important, because they basically disprove the mind-brain, what they call the mind-brain identity theory, which is a very commonly assumed theory these days, that we tend to think that the mind and the brain are identical. Now, in fact, when I studied philosophy at university, it was quite well known that that doctrine or that theory has a lot of very deep level philosophical problems. It's certainly not obvious that it's true, you know, even from a scientific point of view, because the mind is just a different kind of thing than the brain. Yeah, the mind feels and experiences. The brain doesn't feel and experience. The brain is a different kind of thing. It's a physical thing. So even to say in a philosophical sense what that means, to say that the mind and the brain are identical, is not at all clear. But still, it's something which tends to be assumed by a lot of people with a scientific viewpoint, even though they haven't really worked through the philosophical difficulties with that. And but that kind of theory seems to be very clearly ruled out by these kinds of experiences that we're talking about. Yeah, and it's very important to notice this. Sometimes Buddhists get intimidated by science. We feel like we have to adjust or adapt Buddhist ideas in order to fit them in with what science is telling us. Now, of course, in a sense, yes, we have to test our Buddhist ideas, and that's fine. We can use whatever means we like to test them. If that's science, then that's fine. But we have to realize that science also has its limitations as well. It can't answer all the questions. It can only answer certain kinds of questions. So this, when one is doing the meditation, one is really practicing to die. One practices letting go of the body, practices going inside of the mind, practices letting go of all kinds of experience and so on. And this is one thing I was talking with one of the venerable Tibetan monks about this kind of thing, and about this kind of the nature of samadhi. And I said that in our tradition, in the Thai forest tradition, it's always accepted that what we would call samadhi or jhana always has to be like with a feeling of the ending of the body. There's no sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. There's no feelings inside the body. You can't experience anything. You're inside the mind. It's like a one-pointedness. And the Tibetan monk said, yes, you know, of course. He said, that's obviously how we would understand it as well. How could it possibly be called samadhi or jhana if you were still able to experience things through your sense contact? So this is obviously a shared understanding in the different traditions. So when we come to spiritual practice, then on one level or another, either consciously or unconsciously, I think we're all motivated by this fear of death. And this fear of death, how does that come to us? Why are we afraid of that? Yeah, that's a very interesting one. Why are we actually afraid of death? Are animals afraid of death in the same way? Are they? Yes. Dustin's nodding. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fear of the unknown.
But do they know about the unknown? Well, how can they be afraid of it?
Everybody loves life.
Everybody loves life, even animals. Sure, they don't want to let go. What about tortoises? You've got tortoises down in your front yard there. Are they afraid of death? They are. Do they worry about it? If they're threatened, they worry about it. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I mean, all animals love life. And, you know, it's amazing how sometimes animals, even if they're you know, they're in an animal life. I mean, it's not that great. But, you know, even maybe they're injured or they're old or something, they'll still struggle to live. You know, even an insect or something, you know. Sometimes we might hurt an insect accidentally. And I'm sure none of you would swat a mosquito. Would you? Oh, we're getting a nodding from the back. Okay, you have an honest person there. Well, you should be more careful with the mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are living beings. They also love life, just like you love life. Yeah? And if you have enjoying a long life in this life, that's because you have been kind and helpful to animals and to others in your previous lives. Yeah? So if you want to also enjoy long life in the future, you should also do the same thing. Yeah? So always need to respect that kind of oneness of our lives. Yeah? We experience pain, they experience pain. We like to experience happiness, they like to experience happiness. And so we share this fear of death with the animals and so on. But there is something that's a little bit different, even though the animals do fear death. As Dustin was saying, they fear it when they're threatened. But if they're not being threatened, they probably don't fear it, do they? This is the point I was trying to get at. They don't worry about it so much, or probably at all. This is what we call like an existential fear. Like in Western philosophy, we have this word existentialism. And it's like existential fear of death. And what that means is not just you fear afraid of death when you're being threatened or something like that, but you're just afraid all the time, yeah? Because you know that you don't die because maybe someone kills you or something like that. You die because it's your nature to die. Because you've been born, you're getting old, and you know it's inevitable that one day you're going to die. And that fear is what we call existential fear. And that's a fear which is probably unique to humanity. It's like an extra burden that we carry. And it's a burden that we carry because of the power of our minds, because we can conceive of the future. Yeah? So we can understand what it means to talk about the past and the future. We can see the cycles of nature repeating themselves. We understand that now 1 year has gone past, the next year has started. We can look in the mirror, we can see last year I didn't have so many grey hairs, this year I've got some more. Yeah, we can see this passage of time. And so we can extrapolate. Well, and we can think, well, next year I'm going to do this. Next year I'm going to build 2 more kutis in my monastery. Yeah? Well, what am I going to do the year after that? Well, the year after that I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I haven't thought that far in advance, but I don't know, maybe I might do some renovation work on the house we have there or something like that, and so on and so forth. So we can think about the kinds of things we might be planning to do. But we know that there's a limit, isn't there? What am I going to do in 20 years' time, or in 50 years' time, 100 years' time? Now, I'm probably not going to be here in 100 years' time, unless science has made some very wonderful advances in that period. There comes that like gap. This is like we go into this unknown where we say, well, we don't know how long we've got. And this is where that existential fear comes in. And this is where we can reflect, actually, really we don't know even if tomorrow is going to come. Yeah. So this is where we have this very deep level fear. And I think this is something that's with us from childhood, from a time when we're children and we can first start to understand about time and about the future. And we have this fear, this worry that's growing in us, but very subconsciously. We don't know about it. We don't think about it so much. Occasionally we might think about it, but it's always there and it's like prodding us. So most people would turn to escapism. They turn to indulgence or to whatever it might be to try and like paper over the cracks, yeah? And put some wallpaper on the cracks to try to escape from this fear. One of the most moving passages that I always remember in all of world literature. One of my hobbies is I have a fascination with especially ancient writings. So any writings from the time of the Buddha or earlier, I always find extremely fascinating, because you're always seeing the wellsprings of so many ideas and phenomena that we experience in our lives today. And there's a time in history, it's about 1200 BC, where it's like people's... people's way of thinking changed. and it's where they seem to become conscious of death. And it's actually like before that you don't see that consciousness in the same way. And there's some inscriptions in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia, and they're like things like, how does it go now? I used to, for a day a man sings and plays, and then in a moment he is wailing like a mourner. Yeah? Death lies before me today, like a home that a man longs to see after years spent as a captive. Yeah? Very, very powerful lines written so long ago. And it's something that we can relate to quite clearly. We all have this kind of fear. We can feel that common humanity with that person. Of course, the Buddha was one who faced up to this fear. He didn't run away from it. He didn't try to deny it. But he faced up to it. He looked at the various explanations about death that were around in the time of his day, and he didn't accept them because he was a bit of a rebel. He didn't like to just believe what he was told. Now, in the Buddha's day, there were two basic kinds of ideas about what happened at death. One idea was that your body is just made up of the four elements. When you die, the elements dissipate, the earth goes back to earth, the water goes back to the water, the fire goes back to fire, the air goes back to air, and your faculties, your senses pass over into space. They put your body on the funeral pyre, they light it, they burn up your body, and then there's nothing left. Yeah? And the doctrine of survival after death is a sheer doctrine of fools. Now this is one view which was taught in the Buddha's time. So obviously this idea that we only have one life and that there's no life after death, that's obviously not a modern invention. Many people in the past believed that. Of course, many of the other religions had what we call soul theories, okay? Now, essentially, I think what a soul theory is. A soul theory is like to look here, okay, something that's happening here, something that I can identify with that's actually going to survive death. That's what I really think soul theories are about. How can I find something that's going to help, that I can identify with that will survive permanently from death? And of course, all of the different religions have their different ideas about what the soul was. Like some people said that there's a little man the size of your thumb, yeah? And he lives in your chest. And he's a little man the size of your thumb, he lives in your chest, and when you sleep at night, you sleep and your mouth goes open, and then the little man flies out of your mouth, and he goes around and has all kinds of adventures out in the world, yeah? And he goes playing and loving and fighting and speaking with people all in the little adventures. And then when he's done all those adventures, he gets tired and he comes back home, and like a falcon or an eagle folds its wings and comes back and soars down into the nest and returns down, and the little man returns back inside your mouth and goes into your chest. So this is what somebody was asking me before about dreams. So this is one explanation for how dreams happen. You can find in the Brahmanical Upanishads. It's a very beautiful description. And so what these people say is that, now you have to be very, very careful. Don't disturb anybody when they're sleeping. Yeah? Because if you do so, they'll wake up and the little man can't get back inside. Yeah? A big problem, okay? So you have to be very careful with that. And they teach that when you die, then this little man is your soul. And then finally he flies out of your mouth, or maybe he flies out of the top of your head, or whatever different theories will have it, and he'll go up to the moon, or he'll go to the sun, or he'll fly to some heaven realm, or wherever it is. Now this is what we call a soul theory. Now that particular version is a fairly crude one, okay? And we know that we can cut open a person's chest, and that we're not going to find a little man the size of a thumb who lives there, okay? So because there were skeptics in the time of the Buddha, and people would test these theories, okay? So there's a fellow called Payasi, and there's a Payasi Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. And he was a real skeptic, you know, and he used to do all these ways of testing whether there was a soul or not, or anything survived death. One of his ways he did, for example, one of the things he did, he got a man and put him in a barrel or in a jar and sealed it up until he died, yeah? and then watched carefully when they opened the jar to see if anything came out. Nothing came out. So he proved, see, there's no soul, because it didn't come out. And then another one, he did, made a pact with a friend of his, that when his friend died, that he would come back and see him after death. I don't know if anyone's done that or heard of that. Like someone who comes back to see you after they've died. And his friend said, okay, I'll come and see you after death. But then he died, and he didn't come to see him. So Payasi said, see, there can't be any life after death. But then the monk he was talking to said, well, you know, where has he gone? I mean, has he been reborn as an animal? If he's reborn as an animal, how can he come and, if he's a fish, how can he sort of swim up to you and say, hello, I'm your friend? Or what if he's been reborn in the hell realms? What's he going to do? He say, excuse me, good water of hell. Do you think you might just let me out of this pot of boiling lead for a little while I go and pay a visit to my friend? Or maybe he's been born in the heaven realms. So born in the heaven realms and you get reborn there and you think, well, I'll just say hello to my retinue of 500 celestial nymphs first. And then I'll go down and see my friend. But of course, the time in the heavenly realms is very different. So like even one day or even a few minutes might be many thousands of years on earth. Yeah? It's because time moves at different speeds. So this is why these things can't happen. So it can happen sometimes though. I mean, it depends which kind of realm people are born into. Or maybe they're not born in any realm. But there's one story I heard also from, this was in Perth. And this was a fellow who told this was a Scotsman. And Scottish people are kind of renowned for being really kind of skeptical and down to earth and these kinds of things. And he didn't believe in all of this stuff, you know, he didn't believe in ghosts and all these kinds of things. But some strange events started happening to some friends of his, who also he knew from the Buddhist society there. Now these friends, there was a man, this man had been living together with a friend of his. The friend had recently died, and then the man had got a new girlfriend. And the girlfriend was living with him in their house. And this girlfriend was one of those people who, she'd only just been interested in Buddhism and started to meditate, but one of those people who had naturally very good meditation, and even when she just started was able to go in very peaceful states of mind, very clear, pure person. And so she told her boyfriend, she said, listen, there's somebody else in this house. And somebody else is staying here. And he said, well, who is it? And he said, well, he described the ghost or the apparition. And the description was exactly like his friend who had died before. And except one difference was that the ghost had glasses on. And he said, no, it can't be. I mean, my friend didn't wear glasses. And she said, she insisted, no, he's definitely got glasses on. He said, no, he can't have glasses. He didn't wear glasses. And she would show him the photos of his friend. And she said, yeah, that's him, but he had glasses on. He said, he couldn't have had glasses on. And then he remembered that just a few days before he died, he'd been to the optometrist and had got himself some glasses. Yeah. And so all these kind of strange events would happen in the house. And his friend was a real joker. Like before he died, he was always kind of, he was a real practical joker. So he'd do all these kind of practical jokes. Like one thing, for example, like when the house was all locked up, there was one particular lamp there that had like a glass thing around the lamp, and the glass had broken, and this friend had repaired it just before he died. So the couple were out. When they came back, the house was locked, but the lamp was out in the backyard. Yeah, someone had moved it there, and that pane of glass had been broken. The one that had been fixed by the friend had been broken. So many things like this had happened. And when he was thinking about this, that fellow remembered that before he died, his friend had said to him, he played one last practical joke. He said, when I'm dead, I'm going to come back and haunt you. So I have to be very careful with saying things like that, yeah? It might come true. So he said he'd come back and haunt him, and he did. Now, this Scottish fellow was a friend of these people, and he said, rubbish. I don't believe a word of it. You know, poltergeist, load of rubbish. And they were sitting around in the house discussing these things. And they were sitting around the table, and on the table was a vase. And in the vase were some flowers. And while they were talking there, and while this Scottish guy was expressing his contempt and disbelief for all these stories, a petal came off the flower in the vase and came off and floated horizontally across while they were all sitting there watching it, and floated down and landed just on the corner of the table. And they all looked at each other, looked at the petal. He said, "It's the wind. The wind just blew it there, you know. It's just a coincidence." And then another petal came off the flower and also moved slowly across, very, very gently, down, landed, boop, right on top of the first petal. So there were two petals sitting on the edge of the table there. They looked at each other and said, "Well, okay, that was pretty impressive," he said. "But I still don't believe it," he said. "If I see it again, I'll believe it." And then a third petal came off, number three, floated across, down, and then landed. Oop, one, two, three petals there. He said, okay, I believe it. So all these different ideas about that, what is? So what is that thing which is a ghost or which survives death? Now, you know, some of those theories I mentioned before, they are quite crude. But there's other ones which, of course, are much more subtle, aren't they? So, for example, some people think of the soul as being almost like a crystal or a diamond, yeah? And something which is like full of light and purity. And that after death, then that soul will exist as like a radiant crystal, especially if one has purified oneself. So that's something like the theory that the Jains was a contemporary of the Buddha, that's what they thought, something like that. Other people think of the soul as like going to like a heaven realm, where there's going to be divine heavenly music and angels and all these kinds of things. And there was a very good story about that a few years ago that came out, and I'll tell you this one. I find it quite amusing, this story. Whether it's true or not, I can't say. Usually doesn't matter too much. But this particular one I read it in a book or a writing by a Christian evangelical group, and they had written this story, and they said, "Be careful, be sensitive." Okay, who's that downstairs? Oh, okay. They, in the article they wrote, they said, "Be sensitive about sharing this with your Buddhist friends." Okay, so be careful. But this one was about a Buddhist monk in Burma, and he had been, most of the article was written by him, and he apparently been a very diligent monk and done all the right things and so on, and ordained not for a very long time, and then he got some horrible tropical disease and died. After he died, he got taken down to hell. He went down to hell, and there he saw a big lake of fire burning out into the distance, just flames glowing and burning everywhere. And he looked into the flames and he thought, "Oh my God, it's full of Buddhist monks in there." And he saw his own preceptor burning in the fire. Wow. And he was with one of the hell demons. And then he saw some other fellow sitting there, and this fellow had long hair, yeah, sitting there meditating. And he said, "Who's that?" He said, "Well, that's Gotama, the one that you worship. He's sitting there burning in hell." He said, "What?" He said, "Yes, he's there in hell." He said, "That's incredible." He said, "But he was such a good man." And the hell demon said, "Yes, he was a good man." He said, "He never hurt anybody." He said, "Yes, he never hurt anybody. He only ever did good and helped people." He said, "That's right." He said, "Well, why is he in hell then?" He said, "Because he didn't believe in Jesus." It's a bit hard considering Jesus wasn't born for another 500 years. But anyway, I don't know if anyone had told this fellow, this poor Buddhist monk, I don't know if anyone had said to him a very sound piece of advice: never believe anything you're told by a hell demon, okay? So just remember that as a piece of advice, okay? So then after that they took him to heaven, and he went up there and he saw Adam and Eve and creation and these kinds of things, and then he saw the heavenly realms and the beautiful celestial music. And he said, oh, it's just such lovely music. It was just so beautiful. It was so much more beautiful than our music on earth, to hear the heavenly choirs and the angels singing. And then, unfortunately, they told him that he had to go back. They said, you know, your time's not up, you have to go back. And he woke up, and it was in the middle of his funeral ceremony, and he'd been dead for a few days. And all the people were there in the village, and the big hall in the temple, and they had all the fire was ready to be lit, and the coffin was there, ready to go ahead, the monks sitting around doing their chanting, and suddenly the corpse sits up and then tells everyone, give your heart to Jesus. I don't know which was the bigger surprise for them. But anyway, this is another kind of idea that people have. They think they're going to go to some heavenly realm like that. But of course, you know, when we start to think about these kind of heavens, it doesn't take much kind of reflection to think, well, heavenly music might be great, you know, for 1,000 years. Fine, I can listen to that celestial choir for 1,000 years and it'll be beautiful. But it's going to get boring eventually, yeah? No matter how good it is. 10,000 years maybe. After 1,000,000 years, it's going to start to grate on you. It doesn't matter how good it is. What about 1,000,000,000 years of being in a heaven like that? Or like how heaven's described in the Quran, where you're sort of under the fruit trees and you've got the celestial virgins are coming and feeding you with the fruits and things like that. I mean, how long can you dally with the virgins in the heaven realms before it's going to get boring? You know? It's not that long. I mean, come on. So people then start to think of even more exalted theories. For example, like the most refined, I guess, the most refined theory, and it's a very kind of beautiful soul theory, is this idea that in the Upanishads, it's most clearly expressed in Upanishads, Tattvangasi, thou art that. Yeah, the Atman is the Brahman, the little soul in here is the same as the cosmic soul out there. In the Pali canon, they express the same idea. They say, so atta, so loko. The self is identical with the world. Yeah? And so it's this idea of like the infinite self or the cosmic self, yeah? Where each one of us as a little being here is actually the same as this whole universe. Very beautiful idea. And, you know, of all the soul theories and of all of the philosophies of other religions, I think this is the highest and the most exalted theory. And I found first in India, probably before the time of the Buddha, and you tend to notice that with other religions, like Islam and Judaism, Christianity, like when the more very very refined and subtle, both on the mystic side, like the meditative side, and also on the philosophical side, the thinkers, people like Plato or whoever it might be, they tend to move towards this kind of idea, and you find similar ideas actually being expressed in the Islamic tradition or in the Christian tradition and so on. Maybe not in exactly the same way, but similar kinds of ideas, that one is somehow identical with the world or with God or with being or something like that. So this is, of all the soul theories, is very beautiful, but it still has that idea of something. It's still a something. And because it's still a something, it's still imperfect. Yeah? It's never 100%. There's always involved in some way with some kind of tension or some kind of contradiction. For example, we think, okay, we are nothing but the cosmos, and we've emerged out of the cosmos, and then we go back into that, like we emerge out of the ocean. But what is there that's making us come out of the ocean? You know, maybe we're like the rain. The water vapor that rises out of the ocean condenses as in the clouds and then falls again as rain, and we're coming like that. That's a very beautiful image, to think of ourselves in the universe like that. But what's driving that process? There's still something happening there, isn't there? It's still impermanent. There's still something unsatisfactory. There's a tension in that is actually drawing us out into the world and bringing us back. And if we look at these theological religions, even the most very, very refined and subtle ones, like the Hinduism and so on, they're very beautiful philosophies, very, very profound. And they will all attempt to deal with this problem in one way or another. Yeah? Why did God create the world? Yeah? I remember Martin Luther was this great philosopher in Christianity, and he was asked one time, what was God doing before he created the world? And Martin Luther's answer to that was, he was sitting in a forest, a birch forest, making rods with which to hit people who ask impertinent questions. So there's always this kind of, this feeling of there's something in those philosophies which is just, there's still a very subtle attachment, even though it's not, even though it's very, very refined, and even though you can certainly, you know, I think almost all people can progress very, very far if they want to follow those philosophies and religions. I would never tell people not to do that, because I think for where we're at, to follow those ideas, for most people, is very good. And is certainly going to lift us out of our very kind of mundane and trivial way of looking at the world. It's a very profound and very important perspective on the world, but it's not the ultimate perspective, it's not the highest perspective, because there's still some attachment to something somewhere, some attachment to being, some attachment to identity, and some attachment to suffering. Okay? So even this idea that there's like an infinite consciousness, which is somehow the bedrock or the foundation of being, even these kinds of ideas, the Buddha went beyond them. He said, no, that's not the case. Even those states of beings might last countless billions of years, and still they'll come to an end eventually, still they're impermanent. And so still there's a returning back to the cycle of suffering. And so this is what the Buddha was always pointing to. He's saying, if you want to find your escape from death, then find that escape from death. You've got to look for that which is free from birth, aging and death. And he said, if there was not that which is free from birth, aging and death, then there wouldn't be an escape. But there is. Yeah? So this is why Buddhism is sometimes accused of being pessimistic religion. Yeah? Because it says, well, the world is suffering. Yeah? But of course it's not pessimistic, because it doesn't just leave you there. Yeah? One time I was reading, I saw a book on the great thoughts of mankind. Okay, so this is like a big book, thousands of entries in there, the great thoughts of mankind. So I thought, well, let's see what they have under Buddha. So I looked at the Buddha's great thoughts of mankind, and the Buddha's great thoughts, apparently according to this book, were there is suffering and there is an origin of suffering. And that's all they had. Only two noble truths. So I wouldn't call that a great thought. I would call that a mediocre thought. So maybe it should have been in the mediocre thoughts of mankind. Of course, the Buddha's teaching was there was an ending of suffering, and there was a way to the ending. Yeah, and that way to the ending, of course, the Eightfold Path, and practice of sila, samadhi, panya, practice of ethics, keeping precepts, practicing generosity, practicing kindness, practicing letting go. And the samadhi side, being mindful, being aware, being conscious of one's daily, throughout one's life, in all one's activities, trying to be conscious. What are you thinking? What are your moods? What are you doing? Bringing attention to your activities, to your body, to your thoughts. And then practicing meditation, going, finding the peace of the mind. And then there's the path of wisdom, of course, of understanding, of letting go. Of understanding that this, it must be impermanent. My life must have an end. There's nothing in the world that I can cling to. The Buddha said, if there was something, yeah, that you could cling to as a self, if there was something you could say, this is going to be permanent and going to bring me full happiness, then great, go and attach to it. Yeah? So this is, and he said, this is the reason why I teach non-attachment, because there is not such a thing. There is no thing you can find in the world that will be permanent, that will give you perfect, permanent, lasting, eternal happiness. And this is why I teach letting go. So this is the wisest and most sensible and most useful way to respond to death. So if we can do that, then we should have a lot of energy and joy in our life if we're practicing like this. We don't practice reflections on death and life after death and so on because we want to get morbid and depressed and so on, but because we want to release ourselves from these things. So somebody who's doing their practice on death should be someone who's very bright and happy. Someone should always have a smile on their face, because they know that what they're doing with their life right now, right here, that is the best possible thing that they can be doing with their life. Yeah? And this is how we should respond to death. Okay, so that's a little talk now on life after death, and a couple of ghost stories thrown in for good measure.